Mike Malloy, welcome to tonight's program. How's everybody doing, huh? Wasn't that funny last night, the Republican primaries? 30,000 voters in Delaware decided to go nuts, and the political punditry class has lost its marbles today. Oh, well. I have a message for you from AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Listen up. We all know too well what happens when Republicans run the show. Well, I won't add to the copy. Apologies and favors for big oil on Wall Street, schemes to privatize Social Security, and hundreds of thousands more layoffs for teachers, nurses, firefighters. As we get close to November, remember, history only repeats itself if you let it. Remember, remember, the 5th of November. I'm not going to focus an awful lot on what happened last night. Although, I want you, at some point tonight, go to bradblog.com. Go to Brad Friedman's website, bradblog.com. You've got to see this. The lead story, Castle defeats O'Donnell in Delaware. Right. Not the other way around. Castle. Brad writes, yesterday's hotly contested race for the Republicans' U.S. Senate nomination in Delaware ended in victory for the state's moderate, much-beloved former governor and nine-term U.S. Congressman Mike Castle. That is, at least according to the tabulation of ballots cast in the race, which can actually be verified by anybody as having been recorded accurately as per the voter's intent. Now, what he's talking about, verifiable, paper-based absentee results. All Republicans, they have closed primaries in Delaware. The only people who can vote in Republican primaries are Republican. The only people who vote in the Democrat are the Democrat. All right. Verifiable, paper-based absentee balance. Mike Castle, 54.7%. O'Donnell, what's her first name? Christine? Christine O'Donnell, 45%. Unverifiable election day e-voting machine results. Mike Castle, 46%. O'Donnell, 53%. Just backwards. So what does it mean? What does it mean? Oh, God. All right. I don't have time to do everything that Brad Friedman has at his website. But if you want to read some interesting stuff, man, go to bradblog.com, and there's the story, and there are the numbers, and read what Brad has up, and you decide yourself. I like this. Tea Party conservatives emerged from the final big night of the 2010 primary season with at least two shocking upsets. Their pick in Delaware's Republican Senate primary, Christine O'Donnell, toppled veteran Representative Michael Castle, and Buffalo developer Carl Paladino, a political newcomer allied with the Tea Party, defeated former Congressman Rick Lazio in New York's Republican gubernatorial primary. Well, you've heard enough all day. I know you have if you've been paying attention. I'm not going to get into this again. There's a couple of points that I might make later on in the program, but again, the real winners last night were the Democrats, because anyone who thinks that Paladino or Robinson, is that her name, Christine Robinson? Anyone who thinks that they have an ice cube's chance in hell, Christine O'Donnell, I'm sorry, of being elected, deserves to play with her fantasies until reality smacks him in the face. I got an email from Gordon in Oklahoma City. He says, Mike, I'm not sure how you feel about this because there are always worthy causes seeking donations. Yeah, let me digress from Gordon's email. This is just the way it goes. People on the right have all the money in the world, and it's designed that way. Those of us on the left struggle for every dime that we take in, either however we get it, donations, in our case here, podcast subscriptions, a few advertising dollars that dribble in. But it's always those of us on the liberal left who are struggling for money. Back to Gordon's email. This time, two young men of the new left media who brought you the informative videos from the belly of the beast could use some funds. They're college students and about to graduate. Once they are out of school, they will no longer have access to the equipment they need to produce their videos. And Gordon has a link here, newleftmedia.com. I've given that before, but there it is, newleftmedia.com. And he has a link from his blog. Gordon has a blog. Gordon, OKC, like Oklahoma City, OKC.wordpress.com. And he says, again, I'm not sure how you feel about this plea, but any announcement will likely go a very long way to help these brave young men. I think it's a good idea, Gordon. I really do. New Left Media is Chase Whiteside. He's the guy on camera. Eric Stoll. He's the producer. And a camera. They are both students at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. Homeboys. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, geez, they're about to graduate from college. That doesn't mean anything. That doesn't mean anything in the Bush-Cheney economy. It means nothing. So if you're interested, newleftmedia.com. Newleftmedia.com. Thanks, Gordon. Our education affairs correspondent, Kay Petrini in San Francisco, has weighed in. She's kind of pissed off. And I don't blame her. You know, I've been reading some stuff about what the teachers are up against this year. The race to the top nonsense is about as screwball-y as No Child Left Behind. It really is. I mean, what the hell are teachers supposed to do? What are they supposed to do? Who was it said one time the reason they have so much trouble in prisons is because of the quality of the people who are sent there or something like that? What are teachers supposed to do when kids come to school who come to school probably hungry, so many of them, come from broken homes where there might be alcoholism, drug addiction, domestic violence. And I'm not talking about urban inner city kids. I'm talking about everybody across the spectrum. You know how this goes. Don't be a dumbass and start saying, oh, yeah, well, that's the urban, the inner city schools, Mike. No, it's not. Addiction, abuse, domestic violence, and now the horrendous stress that is being placed on families who, where nobody works, or maybe one parent has a part-time job. And into the schools come these kids, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh graders, high school kids, and they are screwed up. And I don't mean they're screwed up on drugs or some phony-ass religion. I mean, they are in bad shape. So what's going to happen to them? Who knows? But what about the teachers who are supposed to educate them? Another aspect of the kids that come in, it's not all just dysfunctional families. The kids that come in who don't read any longer, who don't study, who couldn't read a newspaper if you explained to them what the little squiggly lines meant. Those are words. But spend all their time on their Facebook page or YouTube or texting each other or all this craziness. What the hell is a teacher supposed to do? Rather than say, when I was a kid, I won't say that because that's ancient history, but when my 32-year-old son was a public school student. He is about to graduate university now, but when he was a public school student, the attitude of the teachers then was, be prepared when you come to my classroom. And the kids were prepared. I know, because I was one of the parents to help prepare my kid anyway. And what, here we are, 30 years later, 25 years later. And what are the teachers supposed to do? Huh? So I can understand Kay Petrini's frustration. I'll share with you what she wrote when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Tonight in the program, I have some good news regarding labor relations. Let me put it that way, because I want to tease you a little bit. Some good news and some bad news regarding labor relations and predatory capitalism. It just never stops. One of the stories I have tonight considers broom, 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 Harley Davidson. So stick around. All right? Huh? From Kay Petrini. Hi, Mike. Oh, the ignorance, the appalling ignorance. Here's an exchange I had with someone today regarding the teabagger victories last night. She was responding to a post by a friend of mine who had referred to the teabaggers as nut jobs. Here's the response. Wow, I guess I'm a nut job too, but I'm a freedom-loving nut job. Charlie Crist is a sellout, watching out for his own butt. Rubio is what hardworking America is all about and what made America a great country. His parents were legal immigrants and didn't take handouts or entitlements. Educate yourselves and don't believe everything the left-wing media tells you. The Tea Party was formed because the majority of Americans are fed up with the socialist direction of America. Don't tread on me or my Constitution. Democrats are out! Back to Kay. As the bumper sticker says, stupidity should be painful. I don't know why I even bother anymore, but I did. Here's my response to that post. There is more than one kind of socialism. There is totalitarian socialism, like communism, or national socialism, fascism, and there is democratic socialism. The two forms are deliberately conflated by the right so as to demonize all socialism. In fact, the democratic form works incredibly well. I experienced it living in Germany, which is just as free and capitalistic as the United States, but has a better social safety net. We have democratic socialism here in the United States, too, and thank goodness for that, because I personally like the fact that I can call 911 and have the cops or fire department show up in an emergency. If you're upset about illegal immigrants, then you need to go after the people, especially the large corporations like Coke Foods, who actively recruit and transport workers from Mexico so they can pay substandard wages and pad their own fat wallets. And while you're at it, get some of those Tea Party folks to support the repeal of NAFTA, which has allowed U.S. agribusiness to flood the Mexican market with cheap products, putting thousands, if not millions, of Mexican farmers out of business and conveniently providing a large supply of wage slaves for U.S. employers. Never mind what so-called free trade has done to our own economy, i.e. turned us into what we were in the beginning, colonies supplying raw materials to an imperial power. Back then it was England, now it's China. The Tea Partiers and the rest of the right wing see no problem with this. As to the demands of the Tea Party that we get back to the Constitution, Be prepared. That original constitution contained no voting rights for women, counted African Americans as three-fifths of a human being, and provided no equal protection under the law, among many other items that we now take for granted. If the media were, in fact, left-wing, all of the above would be common knowledge. It is not, which is why millions of people like those in the Tea Party will continue to vote against their own best interests and in favor of the very people who have put them in their dire situation in the first place. A process which started all the way back in 1981. Any spelling or grammatical errors are due to the fact that I wrote this in a hurry and I was really, really pissed off. K. See, my problem with that, Kay, and I got a couple other emails today from people. I'm going to share one with you a little bit later in the program, I think. People who make the effort to explain to these flat-lined, brain-dead, crazed, white, right-wing, incipient fascist teabaggers the uselessness of trying to talk to them is evident in the fact that no matter how you explain slowly, small sentences, non-polysyllabic words, no matter how slowly you explain, it doesn't matter. It doesn't register. It doesn't sink in. They stare at you. And once you finished, if they let you finish, they start regurgitating what Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and the rest of the right-wing nut jobs have pumped into their heads. A teabagger, a Republican, a conservative, never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, has an original thought or the ability to justify his or her position, which is, cut taxes! Get the government out of everybody's business! I want to go back to the Constitution! We got to take our color, our country back from the colored guy in the White House! That's what this is all about. We'll be right back. Underestimate the prophet crusader. Can I count on your support? Will you be giving me your vote? I promise not to let another pretzel near my throat. My brother Jeff in Florida will oversee the count. The Supreme Court will decide if we don't get the right amount.
Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang.
Hey, truth seekers, gather around the campfire. It's more Mike Malloy. When you walk
that walk. Welcome back. And you talk 25. Before the hour. Out off my feet. Boom, boom, boom. From the, from the Associated Press, from Harrisburg, PA, Captain Mary let me know that this story was out there. I would have missed it. Information about an anti-BP candlelight vigil, information about a gay and lesbian festival and other peaceful gatherings became the subject of anti-terrorism bulletins being distributed by Pennsylvania's Homeland Security Office. That's according to an apologetic Governor Ed Rendell. Rendell, who claimed he just learned about the practices, said yesterday that the information was useless to law enforcement agencies, and distributing this information was tantamount to trampling on constitutional rights. In recent weeks, several acts of vandalism at drilling sites spurred the inclusion of events likely to be attended by environmentalists, and the bulletins began going to representatives of Pennsylvania's booming natural gas industry. You see how this works? even in a state ostensibly run by a Democratic governor. You see how this works? Environmentalists put them on the list because acts of vandalism have occurred at drilling sites. A Philadelphia rally organized by a nonprofit group to support Governor Rendell's push for higher spending on public schools even made a bulletin. That's on the list. Watch out for these people. As did drilling protests at a couple of Rendell's news conferences this month as he toured the state to boost support for attacks on the natural gas industry. Right? Rendell said at an evening news conference, quote, I am deeply embarrassed and I apologize to any of the groups who had this information disseminated on their right to peacefully protest. End quote. Rendell called the practice ludicrous and said the fact that the state was paying for such rudimentary information was stunning. Still, Governor Rendell said he was not firing his Homeland Security Director, James Powers, but he ordered an end to the $125,000 contract with the Philadelphia-based organization, the Institute of Terrorism Research and Response, that supplied the information. The 12-page bulletin that was issued August 30th included a list of municipal zoning hearings on Marcellus Shale natural gas drilling on a forest industry conference, and information on the screening of the documentary Gasland. These are all events, according to Pennsylvania's Department of Homeland Security, these are all events likely to be attended by anti-drilling activists. Ooh! You see what's going on here, right? This is what people on the left have been talking, including me, have been talking about for a long time. Private security or investigative organizations working under contract to a state or a city or the federal government, a contract paid for with tax dollars, that issues reports and warnings and spies on peace groups, labor activist groups, environmental groups. Right? Now, why do you suppose they would do that? Well, the answer, of course, is very simple. This is what fascism looks like. This is what capitalism slash fascism, they're not too much difference. This is what they look like. This is how it evolves. This is how a society that considers itself to be free at some point in its existence becomes a society that is no more free than somebody locked into a prison somewhere. Pennsylvania, for God's sake. Aside from the drilling-related events, the bulletin mentioned other potential security concerns that it said could involve, quote, could involve anarchists and black power radicals. Black power? Hey, you dumbasses, we have a black president! Oh, my God. It listed demonstrations by anti-war groups, deportation protesters in Philadelphia, mountaintop removal mining protesters in West Virginia, and an animal rights protest at a Montgomery County rodeo. It also included Burn the Confederate Flag Day, the Jewish High Holidays, and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan as potential sources of risk. Governor Rendell said he learned of the matter from a story in the Patriot News of Harrisburg, PA on Tuesday and was appalled that his aides did not notify him before signing the contract a year ago. Oh, my God. Rendell said, I think I would have said no to this contract before we ever spent a dime and before we sent out any information that was wrong and violative of, in my judgment, the Constitution. Violative? Is that a word? Violative? Mike Perlman, a co-director of the Institute of Terrorism Research and Response, Mike Perlman, co-director of that would not respond to questions about the contract or the bulletin, saying he does not discuss client matters. We don't discuss client matters. We just take the money. The bulletins, which went out three times a week, were not intended for public distribution. But someone who received the August 30th bulletin gave a copy to Virginia Cody, a retired Air Force officer, who lives in Factoryville, PA, and is concerned about the rapid expansion of the Marcellus Shale drilling in northeastern PA. Cody, who's 54, said, "The idea that my government thinks that what I'm doing is worthy of anti-terrorism interest goes against everything I stand for and everything I ever stood for." Cody gave the document to a friend who posted it on an online forum, largely read by drilling opponents. She would not say who gave her the bulletin, just that the person works for a private company and was intended an intended recipient of it. Security reports, surveillance reports going out to private corporations, notifying the private corporations, information put together by a neo-fascist organization that has, these different organizations have all kinds of really cute names, the Institute of Terrorism Research and Response, run by someone named Mike Perlman. Information about legitimate protest, or not even protests, just legitimate gatherings, that information surveilled, information intercepted, or just, I don't know, taken off a website, but put together in a bulletin form and sent to corporations. Son of a bitch. What do you call that, truth seeker? Since when are... Oh, don't, Mike. Don't even say it. Don't even say something like, since when are people who exercise their constitutional right to protest considered to be candidates for surveillance by anti-terrorism organizations? We all know when that started. This is a good one. Melting ice forces 10,000 walruses ashore in Alaska. Wonder what the half governor of Alaska, former half governor, has to say about that. Female walruses traditionally like to spend the summer lounging on slabs of sea ice with their young. But over the past few weeks, thousands of these mammals have given up their free-floating lifestyle and taken up residence along the Alaska side of the Chukchi Sea. An estimated 10,000 to 20,000 Pacific walruses, mainly mothers and calves, are resting along the coastline, gathered in tightly clustered pods. This is the third time such a sea-to-land migration, common in Russia but historically unprecedented in Alaska, has taken place in the last 4 years. The unusual behavior appears to have been triggered by the slow warming of the Arctic waters through climate change, which in turn has shrunk the amount of thick walrus-suitable sea ice. Last week, the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center reported that Arctic sea ice coverage had fallen to its third lowest level since records began in 1979. Only 2007 and 2008 saw lower levels. A spokesman for the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program said, quote, as the ice decreases, the walrus are abandoning it earlier and earlier, end quote. Most of these walruses are females, and the bottom line to this story is, if you're a walrus lover, if you like walruses and want your kids to know what a walrus is, get some pictures off the internet quickly before they all disappear. We'll be right back. Amazed.
House in the morning. The terrorists or Democrats strike without warning. So to your backseat in bed, wear a bucket on your head. That's what I said. And to show your support for right-wing ideology, the raids on Iraq and the rape of the ecology, all the treasuries being bled. Keep a bucket on your head. You won't need any eye holes, they'll just tell us what we see.
I don't know why I'm passing this on to you, but I will. It's in the LA Times. You can go there. Republican gubernatorial candidate Meg Whitman gave her campaign another $15 million yesterday. The latest contribution brings Meg Whitman's personal spending in this race to become the governor of California to $119 million. That's how much she's spent, shattering the record for most money ever spent by one political candidate on a single election in American history. $119 million. Meg Whitman. Now, why do you suppose she's willing to spend all that money to become governor? Come on. Finally, after decades of debate, the Food and Drug Administration, the vaunted FDA, appears ready to issue its strongest guidelines ever on animal antibiotic use. Huh? Intended to reduce what the FDA calls a clear risk to human health. All those antibiotics that's making all of us incapable, our immune systems incapable of fighting back against invasive organisms, and especially when we have to use antibiotics, God forbid we ever have to, but when we do, they're no longer effective because of this. The guidelines would end farm uses of the drug simply to promote faster animal growth. That's why these piglets and cowlets and goatlets and all these chickenlets, they're all given antibiotics. And then you and I, if we're stupid enough to eat that stuff, we absorb it. The FDA's final version is expected within months and comes at a time when animal confinement methods, horrifying. Safety monitoring, horrifying. And other aspects of so-called factory farming, horrifying, are also under attack. The federal proposal has struck a nerve among major livestock producers who argue that a direct link between farms and human illness has not been proved. Nobody's ever proved that cigarettes cause cancer. How many years did we hear that? Huh? The livestock producers are vigorously opposing this ruling, even as many medical and health experts call it too timid. It doesn't go far enough. Scores of scientific groups, including the American Medical Association and the Infectious Diseases Society of America, are calling for even stronger action that would bar most uses of key antibiotics in healthy animals, including use for disease prevention. Doesn't that kind of make sense? Of course, factory farming, when you take these poor, dumb creatures and stuff them into conditions that whenever we see the videos, right, of the cows falling down and the chickens and the pigs. And I'll tell you what, if you eat pork, you're really taking a chance, because, you know, pigs and humans, it's been proven that pork, especially ham, tastes the same, whether it comes from a pig or a human's ass. It's the same. It tastes the same. Do you not get that? The genetically pigs in... Oh, never mind. Scores of scientific groups, including the AMA, are calling for even stronger action. Dr. Gail Hansen, a veterinarian and senior officer of the Pew Charitable Trust, said, "Is producing the cheapest food in the world our only goal? Those who say there's no evidence of risk are discounting 40 years of science. To wait until there's nothing we can do about it doesn't seem like the wisest course." But capitalism, Dr. Hansen, doesn't give a damn about your science. A. B. Capitalism doesn't give a damn about how many people get sick or die. How many times do I have to tell you that? Oh, wait a minute. I've never told Dr. Hansen that. The National Pork Producers Council said, quote, there is no conclusive scientific evidence that antibiotics used in food animals have a significant impact on the effectiveness of antibiotics in people, end quote. Oh, for Christ's sake. Who could make a statement like that? Except an out-of-control, filthy capitalist. Huh? Who can make that statement? 40 years of science. Everybody knows that the indiscriminate use of antibiotics into the food supply, into the pigs and chickens and ducks and geese and cows and whatever the hell else we eat. What else we eat? Goats, rats, I don't know what, whatever we eat, loaded with antibiotics. And these rat bastards, the National Pork Producers, say, there's no conclusive scientific evidence. Remember the tobacco executives who sat there before Waxman's House committee and said, there is no, there never is any evidence of, what was the question? Nicotine manipulation? No. And for years, how many times did the second largest purveyors of death in the United States, tobacco producers, how many times did they say, no, it doesn't cost, I might give you a little cough, but that's right, it'll go away, don't worry about it, smoking is safe and fun and adult and makes you look cool. Ah, look at the movies. So when the Republicans take over, which they surely will, right? Rulings like this, of course, will be eliminated immediately. C.F., the Bush crime family. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Harley Davis. I got a story for you about Harley Davidson coming up. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Results of a couple of stupid Republican primaries last night that all the mouth-breathing pundits on television want to interpret as the flood! The flood! It's coming! Hog snot. But just a couple more things here. Walter Shapiro, who is senior correspondent at, well, he writes for AOL, I guess. Is it AOL? Politico? No, not Politico. Politics Daily. Thank you. Writing today, he, he makes a couple of salient points. And I want to cover a couple. Obviously, that's why I'm bringing him up. He mentioned O'Donnell's victory in the Delaware Senate Republican primary last night. And, you know, how As Shapiro says, how do you want to interpret that? You want to interpret it as proof of the potency of the teabaggers? You know, they are riding this crest of voter discontent, and you know, the racist neo-fascist Tea Party group, teabag group, is going to take over in November? No, I don't think so. But as Shapiro says, it can also be viewed as a repudiation of her establishment opponent. That would be Mike Castle, the nine-term congressman. Why repudiate him? The people of Delaware, the Democrats, and the normal people seem to really like him. He was a nine-term congressman. I think he's former governor, all kinds of statewide offices that he held. But he's perhaps the last old-fashioned Republican moderate in the House. And the Republican Party is in, it's kind of like Stalin's purges of the 1930s, when Stalin in old Soviet Russia decided there were too many Jews, too many liberals, too many people who are not dedicated 100%, 120% to the communist system of governing. There were too many, in other words, there were too many socialists in Stalin's government. So what was the best way to handle them? You killed them. That's all. You just, the purges of the 1930s, I don't think anyone ever will know how many Russian bureaucrats were taken out and shot. I mean, literally taken out and shot. Immediately take them. Go get them. The names on the list, shoot them. And there are some people like Sharon Angle, Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, in this group of insane people who claim to be Republicans. There are conservatives. There are people in that group, notably the three I just mentioned, who would like to go out, take people out behind a building and shoot them, shoot their fellow Republicans. They would. Sharon Angle, most notably. I mean, every time Sarah Palin opens her mouth, it seems like she winds up with a lock and load comment. Oh, God. And Sharon Angle said, well, if we don't get what we want, we might have to resort to Second Amendment solutions. Oh, man. I would like to say some things about that, but I would be accused of using horribly vile sexist language, so I'm not going to. But the Republican Party is in that mode right now. They are committing suicide. And I think it's wonderful. What is going to emerge is a truly fascist party. So there will be no question any longer. You'll have a corporatist party on the one hand, that is the Democratic Party, corporatists. On the other hand, you'll have the fascists. Now, the hope is that in the process of choosing over the next 15 or 20 years, if we can hold on that long, between those two parties, the fascists and the corporatists, that there will emerge in our political system a truly progressive party that is a democratic socialist party that will bring an end to predatory capitalism in this country, will truly reestablish freedom and liberty and the ability to run your own farm, own your own business, pay your taxes, abide by the rules, stop warmongering, end the slaughter of innocents that seems to be the hallmark of America's identity. We come into your country and kill everybody. And when we leave enough radioactive debris behind to make sure that people will die or be hideously deformed for the next 15 or 20 generations. That's got to stop. The corporatist party, that would be the Democrats, are not going to stop that. The fascist party is going to increase it. So that's our choice for the next maybe a decade and a half. And the hope is somewhere in the coming madness, there will be the emergence of a rational, progressive, liberal democratic party that will identify itself as social democrats or democratic socialists. And the country can then start that long process of becoming what might have been in the backs of the minds of the racist, genocidal, privileged white people who put this country together to begin with. You think? Maybe, maybe not. So, as Walter Shapiro points out today, what we are seeing is either the repudiation of the Democratic Party Republican Party establishment, or the effectiveness of the teabaggers. I think it's both. I don't think it's an either-or situation. Shapiro says, how large a national trend can be drawn from a primary, Christine O'Donnell's, in which fewer than 60,000 Republicans even voted? And of that group, she got 53%. So she got, what'd she get? 33,000. 33,000 Republicans in Delaware voted for Christine O'Donnell. And Christine O'Donnell stepped out last night, like I mentioned, first hour, and said, the people of Delaware have spoken! Christine, sit down, take a chill pill, shut the hell up. No, they haven't. your little clique of crazy people have spoken. Shapiro also talks about the way the crazy people that talk on television, you know, the mouth breathers, the pontificating pundits on cable TV, have overhyped the cosmic meaning of real estate billionaire Carlo Palladino's lopsided victory over poor old former Republican Congressman Rick Lazio in another low turnout primary for the worthless New York Republican governor's gubernatorial nomination. Like, oh, okay, New York is going to go Republican with somebody like Palladino. Yeah, okay. Now, how do you want to put this politely or delicately about Palladino? Let's call him as Walter Shapiro does, a different drummer candidate with his seeming love for pornographic emails and his propensity for statements like denouncing a Jewish state legislative leader as the Antichrist. But Palladino has as much chance as Elliot Spitzer of being elected governor in November. Andrew Cuomo, the Democratic state attorney general, is going to win in a landslide in this Democratic state. But Shapiro points out something that I think most of us have missed, and I wasn't aware of it until I wasn't aware of the history of it until he pointed it out. I'll share that with you in just a second, as soon as we come back from this break. So just a bit more on this madness that happened last night, and then we're going to move on, because if you get right down to it, what happened in these Republican primaries last night is truly meaningless. It's just gum to chew, and gum that's been sitting on the bedpost overnight. So let's just do it and throw it in the garbage, all right?
Ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's More Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So, hair twisting and thumb sucking and hand wringing going on about the primaries last night, the Republican primaries. Christine O'Donnell is like, I don't know, she just discovered she can walk on water or something. Walter Shapiro, senior correspondent for Politics Daily, you know, points out some fairly elemental facts about these primaries. They don't mean anything. Not these primaries. This is a purge in the Republican Party, and I hope it goes on. And I hope the Republican Party becomes what the Republican Party is supposed to be, and that is the party of fascism. The Democratic Party will become the corporatist party, and then eventually, hopefully, will emerge social Democrats or Democratic Socialists who will begin that long process that that Ralph Nader was never too interested in getting involved in, and that is the building of a political base, state by state, region by region, until finally the country can be governed by people who are sane and not corporatist capitalist monsters. Okay? But as Walter Shapiro points out, ever since 1842, when the first direct primary was conducted in Crawford County, PA, the intra-party battles that are these primaries have launched countless glib theories about the mood of the electorate. Now, I didn't know that the primary system began in 1842 in Crawford County, PA. How about that? You learn stuff all the time, right? Now, this year's cliche is, of course, there's this anti-incumbent uprising. And the most recent casualty, of course, was Senator Lisa Murkowski, who lost to another neo-fascist. This guy, what's his name? Joe Miller or something? No, what's his name? I don't know what it is. It really doesn't matter. Nobody will know his name in the next few months anyway. That was last month in Alaska's Republican primary. So this year's cliche is the anti-incumbent uprising and the ideological fervor of Tea Party activists, where there have been interfamily Democratic battles. Most incumbents in Barack Obama's party have been obsessed with unemployment after the November elections, their own, rather than embarrassment in a primary. For example, Joe Sestak, upending party-switching five-term Senator Alan Spector in Pennsylvania. And Spector wasn't really a Democrat anyway. He's a Republican. So I really do believe that what is going on in these Republican primaries is a couple of things. First of all, these are Stalinist purges. And I say, bring it on. I love to see it. I wish it was more Stalinist, though. I wish some of these people were handled the way Stalin handled the socialists within the communist structure of the Soviet Union back in the 30s. That would be great fun. You know, it'd be like Mexico. No offense to Mexicans, but it'd be like Mexico. All over the place, you'd see bodies turning up, right? Only these wouldn't be people who got in the way of the drug dealers. These would be people who got in the way of the truly democratic process in this country. That would be teabaggers, Republicans. So too bad that Uncle Joe isn't around to really educate these people on how to really do a purge. Wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't it be? Wake up in the morning and, you know, the streets of your city would be littered with corpses. And well, that's the way it was in Russia, in Mother Russia, right? But that's, you know, that's the quick way. The drawn out process of civilized countries like us is to go through these primary purges and cut the dead wood away. And the dead wood in this case happens to be moderate Republicans. Republicans who could still deal across the aisle. Now, I hope that Rahm Emanuel and Barack Obama and all these people who are advising Obama, and especially Obama himself, will take notice that partisanship or bipartisanship that Obama keeps pretending he wants to. No, I don't think he's pretending. That Obama keeps insisting on, Mr. President, grow up. Okay, grow up. There is no such thing as bipartisanship in the political arena in this country. It does not exist. These people would cut your throat given a chance. They're cutting each other's instead. Celebrate it. But understand, Mr. President, there's no such thing as bipartisanship. Two words for you. Mike Castle.
Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. Email here from Arch. And the subject kind of regards 9/11, what occurred in this country on 9/11, and this has to do with what we were talking about last night, the architects and engineers who are insisting that what we thought we saw on September 11, 2001 is not what happened at all, or what we were told we saw. And Arch writes, Mike, I'm 68. I was 20 when my father died on November 19th, 1962. He made me politically aware. At 10 years old, he had me putting up flyers around the project for Adlai Stevenson. When Kennedy was shot, it was like my father died again. Both figures were bigger than life to me. I wrote an essay about a month ago on the two most definitive examples of denial in this country on a mass scale. I called it two icons. They are, you guessed it, the Zapruder film showing the headshot of JFK, and the other being the towers coming down into their own footprints. You don't have to be a ballistics expert or a demolition engineer to understand what you just saw in both cases. When you see a man get his head blown off from the front, it's not a mystery where the bullet came from. Thanks to the scumbag Arlen Specter of the magic bullet theory, who should be in a grave with a noose around his neck, the media, the Warren Report, and the U.S. government, the citizenry, was put to sleep. Then we have the fully documented vision of the towers in a controlled demolition, which we've seen thousands of times and still believe 19 Saudis did it with three hijacked planes. It's funny because the official version corrects those who would call the Saudis Iraqis and say, no, no, it was Saudis, none of which means anything. But the real reason people believe the official version of both tales is that they can't face the implications of the actual truth. If the government killed Kennedy, it meant we were all in danger. No one would dare rebel. The same with 9/11. If it's known that Bush and Cheney were responsible, that's even more horrible to imagine. What recourse is there? The White House is a crypt of bloody secrets, and there is no one who will give them up. I'm lucky my daughters are grown and each have a handle on her life. I truly care about you, Kathy and Molly. You are my friends. I spend each night listening to you because there aren't enough people in my life to discuss these things with. I read and pay attention, and sometimes I feel like Chicken Little. I have lots of friends here, but I am lonely. Arch. Yeah, thanks, Arch. I appreciate the comments there at the end about how you consider Kathy and Molly and me. That's very sweet, very kind. I would agree. And for those who have just either weren't around, which is about almost everybody when Kennedy was assassinated and that horrible weekend unfolded, all the murders that occurred on that weekend, Tippit, Kennedy, Oswald, and who insists that there was no there, that it was what the Warren Commission said it was, a lone gunman who was a pro-communist. He worked for the Free Cuba Committee. Remember all that? Those of you who are old enough, those of you who aren't old enough, maybe you have read about it. I don't know what the history books say at this point regarding that incident. But all you have to do to draw a line from the assassination of Kennedy to the murder of 3,000 people on our soil on September 11, 2001, the line is very straight. And the starting point is Operation Northwoods. It's all there. Damn it. I don't know why everybody has not. Go to Wikipedia. That's all you have to do. Type in Operation Northwoods and see what you come up with. And as you read what Operation Northwoods was, as laid out in government documents, as you discover what the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the great and good United States of America circa 1961-62 had in mind for its own citizens, once you read that, and compare it chapter and verse to what happened on September 11, 2001, if you don't see that the official story of 9/11 is a goddamn lie, if you don't see that, then go back to sleep. Because there's nothing that will reach you. Nothing that will reach you. Operation Northwoods that was put together 50 years before the attacks of September 11, 2001. And it's a blueprint. Read it. It's a blueprint. It's a predictive blueprint. The events that occurred on September 11, 2001 are exactly the events that the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States military laid out 50 years earlier and were ready to put into effect until Kennedy said no, and then they murdered Kennedy. Period. End of story. I mean, this is, you know, go with Occam's razor. The usually, in a given situation, the most obvious and simple explanation is the right explanation. That's all. So, and the further we get away from the events of November 22nd, 1963, and the further we get away from the events of September 11th, 2001, the less chance there is of reaching into the memory hole and trying to retrieve the truth. So, people in my age group will never know the truth of either event. Never. There's not enough time. And we have gotten further away from those two truths than closer to them with the passage of time. And that's the way it's going to continue until some point in the distant political future where we will find out what really caused the shots on Fort Sumter, so to speak. Not what the revisionists want us to believe. But like I said, people of my generation will be long gone when that truth comes out. Regarding the corporate taxes that we were talking about last night, Michael and Roswell, I think we were talking about in the context of most corporations are paying as little as, as little as they can. Corporations do not contribute to the well-being of the United States. Capitalism never contributes ultimately to the well-being of any society. Capitalism contributes to its eventual dissolution, downfall, and destruction in every single instance. Now, it may not be so obvious. I mean, would you say that American empire is dead? We still have the military. We project our military force all over the planet. But would you say American empire is dead? Check out with the people back here in the United States. Compare what the racist genocidal framers had in mind, not in practice, but what they had in mind when they laid out the declaration in the Constitution and apply it to what goes on in everyday life in this country now. And then you decide. But anyway, Michael writes, corporate taxation in this country is a joke. And the Government Accountability Office pretty much proved it recently. They looked at taxes paid by U.S. corporations during the late 90s and early the early part of this century. In that time period, 60% of U.S. corporations paid no taxes. Do you understand that? And 94% of corporations paid an effective tax rate of 5% or less. No country in the world has a lower effective rate. Except Iceland. And look at them. Anyway, 60% of U.S. corporations paid no taxes, and 94% of corporations paid an effective tax rate of 5% or less. Now, is that right? Is that how citizens of this country want it? You pay a higher tax rate, you do, than General Electric. Is that right? Then Boeing aircraft. Then, I mean, is that right? You pay a higher effective tax rate than ExxonMobil or BP. Is that right? The teabagging morons will tell you, yeah, that's right, that's right. They don't know, of course, they don't know what they're talking about. In the 1950s, Michael writes, corporations paid roughly 30% of all tax revenues to the federal government. 30% of everything the government got came from corporations. By 2006, that share was down to 8%, and now is likely down to 6%. Michael says, I give them 10 years, and with non-taxable subsidies, there will be a net outflow from the Treasury to corporations, which is exactly what the big corporations are aiming for, to be subsidized by the taxpayers. 10 years. Now, that is what you call fascism. We'll be right back.
Before the hour.
Remember a couple of weeks ago with the appropriate amount of outrage, I was talking to you about Dr. Pepper Snapple up in Rochester, outside of Rochester, New York, because prevailing wage rates in that area of high unemployment had been driven into the ground. The Mott's apple juice plant in Williamson, New York said, well, we're going to reduce everybody's pay because we're paying you too much. Very profitable company. Well, according to Stephen Greenhouse, writing in the business section of the Times yesterday, and I missed this, I forgot to mention it last night, Dr. Pepper Snapple and the union representing 300 workers announced a settlement Monday that ends a 16-week strike. And it does include a wage freeze, but not the pay cuts the company had demanded. It's a three-year deal. The retail, wholesale, and department store union persuaded the company to drop its demand to freeze pensions for current workers, although newly hired workers will not have pensions. They will have 401k plans. Ooh. The workers at the plant, 25 miles east of Rochester, New York, walked out on May 23rd, insisting that Mott's parent company, Dr. Pepper Snapple, was unfair to demand a $1.50 an hour pay cut when it had reported record profits of $500 million last year. The company said that its wage demands were a justifiable strategy to increase competitiveness, right? Isn't that what they always say? Saying the plant's workers averaged $21 an hour, while other food industry workers in the area averaged $14. The president of the union, Stuart Applebaum, said, I think what we got is a victory. We secured the wages, we secured the pensions, and we secured the workers' jobs. And Larry Young, Dr. Pepper Snapple's chief executive, said, quote, from the beginning of our negotiations, we sought an agreement that supported our business, and we're very pleased with this resolution, end quote. He added that the deal would, quote, bring our costs in Williamson in line, end quote. So the CEO, the capitalist pig bastard, after workers who produced record profits, and then the capitalist pig bastard who runs the company tried to reward the workers by cutting their pay, taking away their pensions, removing their medical, their health insurance, everything. That's the reward. That's what capitalism does. That's what capitalism does. You bust your ass. You show the company an enormous level of productivity and profit. And how do they reward you? Listen, we're paying you too much money. The other workers who aren't unionized, who have been beaten and slammed into $14 an hour jobs in this area, the ones that are working, well, we want you to be more like them. So we're going to cut your pay. Stinking bastards, right? So the head of Dr. Pepper, Larry Young, the CEO, from the beginning, we sought an agreement that supported our business. Well, then why didn't you come up with this? You still win a little bit. Any new people that come into your filthy company will not have pensions. So why didn't you propose this to begin with, Mr. CEO? Labor unions nationwide paid close attention to the strike, fearing that if Dr. Pepper Snapple were able to push through substantial cuts in wages and benefits, that would embolden other profitable companies to do likewise. Why, of course. That's how it works. You see, traditionally, American companies have only sought wage cuts when they were losing money, or they were having a hard time competing with lower-cost competitors, like foreigners, maybe, foreign companies. But that wasn't the case with this plant. This plant was highly productive, and the company itself, $500 million in profits last year. Not sales, profits. Under the agreement, Dr. Pepper Snapple, which also markets 7-Up, Hawaiian Punch, Canada Dry, will save money on its retirement plans. Well, the company dropped its proposal to freeze pensions for current workers. The union, in exchange, agreed to lower the dollar-for-dollar match for current workers' 401ks. The deal calls for a $1,000 signing bonus for newly hired workers, and for the company to absorb 80% of health care costs and the workers 20%. The president of the local union in Williamson, New York, said, quote, nobody wins in a strike. Neither side is happy with what we got. Was it worth it? Yes, because we stood strong and the company knows we're a force to be reckoned with, end quote. So, workers around the country, why? People are still working but are not unionized. Why don't they take a look at this and say, son of a bitch, that's the way it should be. What counterbalance do workers in this country have against predatory capitalist companies? I mean, what? It just so happens that a company like Mott's apple juice plant, I guess they could move to China, but who would buy apple juice that comes from China? First of all, it'd be 40% paint thinner, 20% hog intestine, and 10% apple coloring. You know, if it comes from China, that's the way the Chinese produce apple juice. But I wish that unorganized ununionized workers around the country would take a look at this and say, well, son of a bitch, if they can do it, so can we. The fact that 6-8% of the American workforce is unionized is an absolute crime against ourselves. Against ourselves. I am self-employed, but I'm a member of a union. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Of state, county, municipal employees. To wit, we all know all too well what happens when Republicans run the show. Apologies and favors for big oil and Wall Street, schemes to privatize Social Security, and hundreds of thousands more layoffs for teachers, nurses, firefighters, police officers. As we get close to November, remember, history only repeats itself if you let it. Eh? Right? So we go from Mott's apple squeezins to Harley Davidson. Harley Davidson. Boom, 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 boom. Harley Davidson, which is the last company in the United States that produces motorcycles, right? Is Harley Davidson squeezing? This is from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Is Harley-Davidson squeezing its unions with threats of closing its plants because it has to or because it wants to? Oh, no, not Harley-Davidson. Now, stop and think. Who's your typical Harley-Davidson rider? Huh? Who rides Harley-Davidsons? Now, I'm going to get a lot of argument about this, but I frankly don't give a damn. Your typical Harley-Davidson rider is a libertarian-type right-winger. And I just wonder if these people who ride the Harleys, libertarian right-wingers, what they're going to think of this story. Not that they listen to this program, but I just wonder. Question being asked in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, was Harley forced to market, forced by market conditions to demand enormous cuts in jobs, wages, and benefits, or was it a deliberate strategy to take advantage of the economic crisis? Oh my, that's a tough question, huh? For union employees, the answer has little practical impact. Harley made its move, and the only way to save jobs is bowing to company demands. Not true! You can walk out. But Jack Norman, writing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, says, but the answers make a great deal of difference to taxpayers and policymakers. If this is an optional company strategy, there is reason to fear for the future of Wisconsin's middle-class workers. Well, no kidding. And I'm not trying to be a smartass here about what Jack Norman has written. Jack Norman has to write in a style that doesn't offend anybody. Now, evidence points to it being a typical tactic, just like Mott's Apple P tried to do up in New York. Harley made $104 million in profits in the first 6 months of 2010. It did have a $55 million loss in 2009, but that was a strategic choice resulting from a $126 million write-down for discontinued operations. In other words, they didn't lose money. This was an accounting move in 2009. Before that, before the accounting move, so they could say, oh, look, we took a loss. Oh, my God, look here. Before that, the company had made at least $100 million in profits for 15 straight years. Why? Well, because a lot of Americans buy Harleys and because of the workers, the unionized workers who build the damn things because of their productivity and their insistence on excellence. Do you think anybody on the board of directors or in the executive suites of Harley-Davidson ever had their hands on a socket wrench or anything to make a Harley-Davidson motorcycle? Of course you don't. So the New York Times shows Harley-Davidson as the focus of a July article headlined, Industries Find Surging Profits in Deeper Cuts. Industries Find Surging Profits. In other words, continue to beat the American worker into the ground, and you make more profit. Huh? As that article noted, Harley and the companies it typifies are fine-tuning the ability to, quote, raise profits in the face of declining sales, while the benefits are mostly going to shareholders instead of the broader economy. Who's in the broader economy? The people who build the damn things. So all you Harley-Davidson riders, you know who you are. You libertarian right-wingers who say, helmet, goddamn, I'm not going to wear no helmet. That infringes on my Second Amendment rights or something. I don't think anybody who rides a motorcycle should wear a helmet or protective gear of any kind, because the transplant organ business needs your heart, your lungs, your livers, your kidneys, skin tissue, your corneas. And when you're on a motorcycle with no helmet, the chances of your dying increase exponentially. So to all the people who say, I'm not going to wear no goddamn helmet. Good. Don't. Because there are a lot of people waiting for hearts and livers and your organs. And the only way they're going to get them is when you clowns slam into the side of a semi or a mountain or go off a road someplace and die instantly. Because I'm not going to wear no goddamn helmet. Okay? So, but I wonder, you motorcycle riders, what do you think of this, huh? Most of you were working class, worked in factories and manufacturing until your job disappeared. Of course, your Harley's paid for. But how do you feel about the fact that the company that from whom you bought your motorcycle are now saying to working people like you, get out of the way. Get out of the way. You busted your ass for the company. We're going to bust your ass even further. So, are the profits earned by Harley-Davidson the result of sacrifices throughout the company? Like the workers are asked to take wage cuts, benefits cuts. Well, what about up here in the boardrooms, huh? Are the profits earned by sacrifices throughout the firm? Apparently not, Jack Norman writes. Last year, Harley CEO took home $8,864,919 in extras over and above his base salary of $1,105,000. My goodness, he made $10 million last year. The CEO of Harley-Davidson. In 2008, the bonuses totaled $6 million. That's over $15 million in bonuses the past 2 years to the CEO of a company that cries, crisis, crisis, to justify cutting wages and benefits for the workers who put the machines together to begin with. You filthy pig bastards. Does anybody wonder why this country is going right down the crapper? It's because of this! And you know what else? These rich pigs and their corporate whores, no offense to sex workers in Congress, the Republicans and a few Democrats, they want more. They want more! They want to continue their millionaire tax cuts put into place by George W. Bush. I've never seen such greed. Have you? This is what brings about a bloody revolution at some point. Historically, maybe not in this country. Maybe this country has become so beat down and so brain dead that we really don't care anymore. Oh, the CEO made $15 million and they want to cut the wages of the workers. Well, those damn unions, you know, those damn unions. You know, someday I could be a CEO. I don't want anybody cutting my $15 million. Dribble, dribble. Jesus God. Members of Harley-Davidson's board of directors each collected, and if they aren't already employees of the company. I'm talking about, well, let me do this when we come back, because this is going to shock you too. The board members, people who have nothing to do with the running of the company, or the hiring and firing, or setting wages, people who just sit on the board and hire the CEO. Wait till you hear this. Stay with us.
I saw the boss come walking down along the factory line, saying, boys, we have to tighten up our belts. But he didn't look any thinner than he did a year ago. And I wonder just how hungry that man felt. He knows it ain't hard to get along with somebody else's troubles. They don't make him lose any sleep at night.
Radio matters here.
21 past the hour. So Harley Davidson has decided they're paying their workers too much, just like the Apple juice company did. So the CEO, Harley CEO, last year took home $10 million in 2008. His bonus totaled over $6 million. $15 million in bonuses to the CEO, and they've had two of them in the past 2 years, to a company that cries crisis to justify lower wages and benefits for the workers who make the damn things. Now, what about the board of directors? Each collected $80,000 as just a fee for being on the board in 2009, plus $50,000 worth of stock. They just sit on their ass, maybe a twice-a-year meeting. That's it. During this crisis, board members never lost their $1,500 annual allowance for clothes and accessories and their free use of a motorcycle if they wanted one. Can you believe this? $1,500 a month, a year, for clothes and accessories. Now, all you hard-ass libertarian Harley Davidson riding mofos out there, I see you every weekend up here in the North Georgia mountains. I see you. Woom, woom, woom. And you got that look on your face with your main squeeze with her big ass on the seat behind you, right? And I see you right her. Boom, boom, boom. What do you think of this, boys? Huh? What do you think of this? It doesn't matter to you, does it? You don't give a damn. You're a libertarian. You're a conservative. You think Sarah Palin is the cat's ass, don't you, boys? Huh? Yes, you do. Harley-Davidson's take it or we'll leave threat is a corporate strategy that is chosen because it works. Pretty simple. We can take our company out of Wisconsin, like we did in York, Pennsylvania, Well, we did really take it out. Here's what happened. Harley used this identical technique last year in York, PA. The workforce was cut in half, and a new category of casual workers was created with lower wages and no benefits. They're making the same motorcycle. The same CEOs are taking $10 million a year. The same board of directors have their $1,500 clothing allowance. But the workforce, it went from union to what is called casual workers, and the state of Pennsylvania provided job training to teach the casual workers how to come in and put together a motorcycle. And low-interest loans to Harley. For what? I don't know. And $15 million for upgrades to their plant. And the workers, get out of town. What are you talking about? Mercury Marine, you know, Mercury Outboard Motors, they used the same trick last year in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, forcing the union to take major cuts while state and local officials produced a hefty package of taxpayer-funded incentives just to keep the predatory sons of bitches in Wisconsin. Now, you got to draw a conclusion from all this. This is the strategy du jour for large corporations all over America. All over America. The workers who made them profitable cut their throats and giggle while they bleed. But I, you know, this thing about Harley, and there's more. I'll come back to this after the break. But this thing about Harley, I just have to ask the question to all you big time, great big old Harley Davidson riding dudes out there. I'm a libertarian. I got an American flag on the back of my bike. What do you got on the back of yours, boy? One of them goddamn evolved fishes? You got some sticker on your car that says Kerouac.com or something? I'm a real American. I drive a Harley. Okay, boys, fine. That's all well and good. Now, what are you going to do about this? Your fellow bike riders, people who would like to have a Harley, and a lot of them did, until Harley said to the workers, oh, look, you guys have been doing a great job. So great, in fact, we're going to cut your throats. What are you Harley riders going to do now? I keep asking the same question over and over again, don't I? Because I know the answer. This is what makes your humble and obedient servant here insane. Because I'm asking the same question over and over, expecting a different answer. And that's a mark of insanity. So, yeah, I'm crazy. I admit I'm crazy. I just wonder, though. I can't help but wonder, because I see you guys all over the North Georgia Mountains. I see you all the time. I saw you last weekend. I saw a bunch of you. My wife and kid and I went up to pick apples up in orchards up in North Georgia. And 20 miles from where we were picking apples was a goddamn Klan rally. Yeah, that's right. North Georgia, up in Hiawassee, Georgia. There they were. 40 or 50 full regalia Klan people, right? And parked around the periphery of this demonstration of idiocy, bunch of Harleys. I saw them. Now, am I saying the Klan members rode the Harleys? No, I'm not saying that at all, although they probably did. I'm just saying, I see you people up here in the North Georgia Mountains every single weekend. We got some real just fun roads to ride up here, don't we? Hairpin turns and curves and plunges 8,000 feet. Well, not that much. Come on, Mike. 800 feet down. And there you are, and you're libertarian. I ain't wearing no goddamn helmet. What do you think about what Harley Davidson is doing to your fellow Americans? Anything? Can I get a reaction?
This is an important...
Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So the attempt by Dr. Pepper Snapple to force 300 workers in Williamson, New York, to at an apple plant, apple juice plant there, to take pay cuts resulted in the union going out on strike. And finally, a settlement was reached. The workers did not have to take the pay cuts that these unconscionable predatory bastards wanted them to take. But a lot of the benefits and 401ks and health insurance and pensions and everything were frozen or cut. This is a typical move by capitalist America. This is what capitalism always does. Now we're talking about Harley Davidson. And Jack Norman had this piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is the research director for the Institute for Wisconsin's Future. And he's talking about Harley Davidson and other companies. Harley Davidson's take it or we'll leave threat that we've been talking about for the past 20 minutes. Mercury Marine, Mercury Outboards, they tried the same deal in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin last year, forcing the union to take major cuts. While state and local officials produced a hefty package of taxpayer-funded incentives. This is the thing that just drives me absolutely over the edge. Socialism is acceptable to these capitalist bastards when costs are involved. When profits are involved, it's pure predatory capitalism. Socialism is good for the company. Capitalism is good for the worker. And capitalism, in all its predatory aspects, will cut a worker's throat. When do the workers cut the boss's throats? Now, what would be the most effective way to do that? What do you suppose would happen if the workers at, let's just take the Harley company, Harley plant. If the workers showed up one day, encircled the building, held the executives hostage, just long enough to make their point being, get off our property. Our property. We're taking over this factory. And then the workers, you know, threw the bosses out and then just took over the factory. What would happen? Would the electricity be shut off? The water shut off? The power shut off? Well, that's a possibility. But would the company, would Harley Davidson company continue to turn out quality motorcycles if they got rid of the CEOs and the boards of directors and all the bosses? If they got rid of everybody and just ran the company by themselves? Or are we to believe that the people who make Harley Davidson motorcycles are so stupid they can't supervise themselves? Okay. So, what stops the workers at Snapple, Papple, or whatever, or Harley Davidson, or Mercury Marine, when the workers are threatened like this, when the workers are told, all right, you guys have been real productive, we're having record profits, god damn, our CEOs are making $10 billion a year, and they get a clothing allowance, but we're going to cut your wages. Why don't the workers say, in a pig's ass, you're going to cut our wages and take over? Why doesn't that happen? Why doesn't that happen? Now, what would be the result? Would the Marines come in? Would a company of Marines surround the factory and, you know, lock and load and say the workers come out or we're going to kill you? Or would the people that depend on those wage earners, would the people rise up and surround the factory and say, all right, if you want to take over the factory, take back the factory, capitalist America, you're going to have to come through us. What's to stop that? Is it the Lordstown Syndrome? You know what the Lordstown Syndrome is? That was named after Lordstown, Ohio, back in the, 70s? People who worked on an assembly line, assembling cars, and the bosses kept speeding up the line, and the workers who would go in there, they would go to work for 35 years, and then they would come out, and they would all be brain dead and completely demoralized. The on-the-job depression and suicides, Lordstown Syndrome, Lordstown. Look it up! Has nothing to do with Lourdes, France. Lordstown, Ohio syndrome. Look it up. But this is what capitalism does. So what's to stop the workers? Lordstown syndrome? Ennui? Inertia? The only resistance to any of this is coming from these psychotic teabaggers who don't have a plan, don't know what to do. Most of them are fat, incapable of walking 5 miles. And like to cluster around candidates who are inarticulate or send porn through the mail, email. They're a bunch of goddamn losers. So where's the working class? Where are the workers? How about all you Harley Davidson riders out there? You're not all retired. You're not all gray beards who ride around with your 80-pound overweight old ladies behind you. You're not all that way. Some of you still work, and you're working class. What are you going to do about this when it's time to buy a new motorcycle? Now, you can't not buy a Harley because that would just punish the very workers themselves. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do, boys? Some business consultants, Jack Norman writes in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, some business consultants have likened the strategy of threatening the workers to take pay cuts or they're going to leave town, leave the country, to a cash cow. This is a cash cow. A business operation that requires little investment but returns large profits. That's what capitalism's all about. The cash cow approach includes demands for three kinds of concessions from workers and local governments. You ready? First, a reduction in hard costs like state and local taxes. They don't want to pay any taxes. Why should they? They're bringing jobs in. Second, a reduction in soft costs through taxpayer-funded loans or infrastructure. That would be like, who's going to build the building? Who's going to lease the land? Who's going to put in the sewer system? Who's going to bring in the power lines from the road? Who's going to do all that? You and I. We're going to do that. Because these capitalist predators insist on socialism for them and hard-ass predatory capitalism for everybody else. When it's involved in these kind of costs, you see. And third, a reduction in human resource costs through wage and benefit reductions, as well as taxpayer-funded job training. That's what capitalist America demands. You guys put up all the money. You pay for everything. We'll take the profit. And once we become profitable because the workers are busting their chops to do a good job, then we'll threaten to leave the country unless you all take wage concessions, wage losses, retirement benefits out the window, 401k contributions down the pipes, a change in how the health care is paid. Oh, and local governments, if you don't give us more money, screw you, we're leaving. There go your payroll taxes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Harley Davidson's approach, both in Pennsylvania and in Wisconsin, typifies the cash cow corporate stance toward workers and taxpayers. The CEO of Harley, Mr. Wandell, said the company was open to incentives. Hey, we're open to incentives. What are you going to do to keep us here? What are you going to do to keep us here instead of having us move our company to, throw a dart, Philippines, China, Vietnam, Morocco? What are you going to do to keep us here? And state officials have obliged Harley-Davidson in Wisconsin with a still-secret package of tax-funded benefits for the corporation. Tax-funded? Oh, but I thought the baggers and the Republicans insisted that that shouldn't happen. Oh, my goodness. Well, here's your target, boys and girls. Hey, Sarah Palin, go picket the Harley-Davidson factory. Huh? Can you do that? Hell no, you can't, you phony. Why is the cash cow strategy a problem? Jack Norman asks. Well, as more companies demand it, it reinforces the trend toward higher profits, lower wages, fewer jobs. That's how capitalism works. That's what it's designed to do. Why is this a surprise? It's a surprise because for 80 years we have had in place a system of speed bumps, let's call them, where corporate America could not just run over the worker. Where capitalism could not just absolutely gut everything that they touched. The speed bumps are being taken away by people like Sharon Angle and Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich and this clownish freak who just won the Republican nomination in Delaware. They're being taken away. And why are they being taken away? Because that's what these candidates are paid to do. The concessions that Harley-Davidson demands reduce the number of middle-class jobs at $30 an hour plus benefits, replacing them with positions at $17 an hour and no benefits, and shut your goddamn mouth and be happy you have a job. Meanwhile, the CEOs, they take home $10 million a year and get a $1,500 a month allowance, the board members do, for clothing. Oh, isn't that nice? What is that, one pair of shoes? But it's still $1,500. This elimination of middle-class wages damages local economies, shrinks revenues for public services and infrastructure. You want cops in your neighborhood. You want emergency responders. You want a fire department. You want public school teachers. You want all that stuff. Well, Harley-Davidson and Mott Applejuice, they don't want you to have it. Because in order to fund that, they have to pay taxes or decent wages. And they don't want to do either. And they don't have to. Because if you get a little froggy about this, they will jump.
Well, I'm bound to follow my conscience, and I'll do whatever I can. But it'll take much more than a union law to knock the fight out of a working man. And which side are you on, boy?
An article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel written by Jack Norman, who is research director for the Institute for Wisconsin's Future. And he is using as an example of this cash cow, quote, quote, strategy, Harley-Davidson. And this comes up because of what we talked about a couple of weeks ago over in New York State with the Snapple Apple people and what they tried to do to the workers there. But apparently the strategy, the cash cow strategy, suck local government dry with incentives, beat the workers into submission, take away whatever gains their union has gotten for them over the past 20 or 30 years, and enjoy record profits. And the threat overarching everything is if you don't do this, we'll leave. We'll leave your little puny-ass state and your city and your country. This is what capitalism does. Now, the impact of this cash cow strategy was highlighted by a recent report from the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Now remember, let me back up just a second. The concessions that Harley-Davidson demands from the workers reduce the number of middle-class jobs at $30 an hour plus benefits, replacing some of them with positions at $17 an hour with no benefits. And the elimination, thus the elimination of these middle-class wages, damages local economies and shrinks revenues for public services and infrastructure. Right? Okay. The impact of all this, Jack writes, was highlighted by a recent report from the Wisconsin Department of Revenue showing state tax revenues for personal income and sales tax below even pessimistic estimates, while corporate income taxes exceeded expectations by nearly 20%. In other words, profits are up, employee income and spending are down. Well, hello! So what other result would be expected? Corporations, Jack Norman writes, milking cash from workers and governments alike is a double whammy for taxpayers. It requires low-cost, quality public services to meet the company's needs, right? They want the best, and they don't want to pay for it. All the while shrinking the local tax base. We're going to pay less. We want everything free. In Pennsylvania, Harley won a taxpayer-funded package of worker training, low-cost loans and infrastructure. In Wisconsin, Harley-Davidson won state concessions. And last year, Mercury Marine secured millions in state and local aid. And these rat sons of bitches say they're against socialism? What? In the long run, Jack Norman concludes, this corporate behavior shrinks the state of Wisconsin's middle class, undermining the quality of life, which is Wisconsin's hallmark. And that applies no matter where this formula is put in place. Jack Norman, again, is research director for the Institute for Wisconsin's Future. It just never stops, does it? And it goes unreported. Mainstream media television, instead of gathering together a panel, who would be on the panel? Robert Reich and Rachel Maddow and, I don't know who else, Bob Herbert and, get together one of the typical panels that MSNBC, for example, puts together in order to talk about some chump-ass two-bit election in the state of Delaware where 30,000 people determine who is going to be the Republican candidate for governor. All that focus. Hours of coverage. Did you see it last night? Hours of coverage. And it was so important, the fake liberal Ed Schultz got his bloomers in a wad because he wasn't included on the panel. Oh! And threw a hissy fit in the MSNBC newsroom, right? Did you hear about that? All that attention over nothing. Nothing. Well, in the meantime, in the state of New York, in the state of Pennsylvania, in the state of Wisconsin, deliberate, brutal, blatant attempts, some of which are succeeding, to beat down the American working class, the American middle class, even further, continue with no attention whatsoever. And these corporate predators, these capitalist bastards, they know that. They know it won't get any coverage. Why? Because they own the television networks, too. Now, I'm not suggesting that Bob Herbert or Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow are owned by corporate America. The companies they work for are. They're part of corporate America. But you got to ask yourself, I think, maybe you don't have to ask yourself this, but you might consider it, especially you guys who ride those big-ass Harleys. Huh? Come on, boys. You know who I'm talking to. You're all over North Georgia every weekend. Right, damn right. Room, 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 you libertarian right-wingers, right? What do you think of this? You got to ask yourself, how much more of this can the American working class, middle class take before the whole thing collapses? Do you know how much it costs to buy a new Harley that'll hold the huge ass of some of these 50-year-old men and the huge asses of their 45-year-old girlfriends? Do you know how much money it costs to buy one of those Harleys? Have you priced one lately? My first house didn't cost that much. And so it goes. Harley Davidson, America's motorcycle. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.